Are you a prepper or homesteader looking to connect with like-minded people in your area? Looking to start your own preparedness group? Already have a group? Well, look no further than PrepperNet. PrepperNet is dedicated to personal responsibility, individual freedoms, and being self-reliant. PrepperNet has monthly meetings in over 100 cities where you can meet and learn with like-minded people in your area. PrepperNet, where preppers unite. Find us online at PrepperNet.com.
Survive, thrive, stay alive. It's time to get prepared with the Prepping Academy podcast.
Hey, we're going to get started. I can't wait any longer. This is a long time waiting to have such an expert on our show. So I do have a few announcements like always. Y'all can complain right there in the box like you always do about my announcements. And this will go on just like normal. So I do want to welcome everyone. My name is Forrest Garvin. I am the founder of a group called PrepperNet. We're 50,000 plus strong. We've got meetings throughout the United States. And we want you to join us. One of the sayings that I say that you'll hear me say if this is your first time is if you're not in a group, you're going to die. So you need to be a part of a group. So what we do is we provide a venue where you can meet other people locally and possibly form a group or get at least to get, you know, get to know other preppers in your area. We've been doing this for six plus years. We started in the Carolinas. We grew. I think we're actually in 78 cities. I actually have a city list of it, I think is my next slide. And it's going to go, it's not going to say when. Thanks, when. Forrest, too. Great. Awesome. If you can see that, that is the cities that we're currently in, plus five more that aren't on there. I noticed there are five or six that I forgot to put in there. And so if there's a city near you, we have meetups that you can go and meet other people. We have city leaders that will kind of help organize it and have some teaching, but it's all about networking. You got to network. So if you go to PrepperNet.com, join our Facebook page, tons of information, also tons of people that will help you as well. So how do we do this? So we do have a premium. It's free to join PrepperNet, absolutely free, and go to our meetups, free of charge, absolutely. We do have a premium member thing. It's $40 a year. That helps me pay for all this. Our meetup sites alone cost me $6,000 a year. So, but that helps us kind of pay for it. If you like these videos, you're getting anything out of it. Tonight, I should charge everyone like $300. I mean, because that's what the information is worth. So, I mean, you can just send me checks. No, I'm kidding. This is going to be awesome information, though. But you can go to PrepperNet and join as a free or basic, whatever suits you. I also want to mention that I just published a brand new book. It's called Stand Firm to the End. It's my second book. It has some great response out there. You know, family and friends buy it, and it made me look like I was a bestseller because it actually had that tag, which was crazy. But anyway, it's a great book. It's 70 pages. And the first one, The Case for Christian Preparedness. This is why you read these. This is why I do what I do. If you want to know, you know, where I'm coming from, it's they're both on Amazon. And if you know anything about books on Amazon that are about 70 pages, if you buy like 100,000 of them, I make like $3,000. It's like ridiculous. You especially the smaller books. So I'm trying to get rich. So I'm hoping to sell like 300 million, maybe. I don't know. Not going to happen. Anyway, that's for your reading pleasure. Also, next week, we have Ross Powell on. He is the owner of Survival 401k. This dude will show you how to make investments with your 401k, your IRA, into physical assets like gold and silver where you own it. Even guns and ammo, if you can find ammo. Also, retreat property and food. you can actually buy that stuff legally from your 401k or your IRA. That, and you know what? I've done it myself. I have many people that I know have done it. And hey, at least come and learn about it. He's going to talk about, you know, how to own gold and silver and things like that as well. So anyway, that is coming next week, October 15th. So don't miss that as well. And so in our virtual green room, I'm going to add him in here to the screen so you can see him a little bit. This is Dr. Arthur Bradley. Dr. Arthur Bradley is I don't know, anyone's like an engineer and a doctor and works for NASA, you just label as a genius. I don't know. But Dr. Arthur Bradley, he's written a lot of books. We're going to talk about his books. He has some products on his website. We're going to talk about some of that. But he works for NASA. I mean, like NASA, you know, the ones that send stuff up in space. So before we all started tonight, I asked him if he could get me a sun oven in one of the, you know, going up in a satellite so we can put it on the moon. You know, people get hungry on the moon too. So if we get a sun oven there, can you imagine the shot? That would be awesome. But Dr. Arthur Bradley has a website there. Make sure you visit his website. He's going to answer a lot of questions. So I want to tell you how it's going to work. We're going to bring, he's in, he's listening, he can hear us. We're going to bring him in. We're going to talk a little bit about his website, about what he does, and some of the products he has, and his books, of course. But then today I posted on Facebook questions that you guys wanted to ask him. And so I have a bunch of questions. I have them right in front of me that as of like 7 o'clock, if you didn't get it on there before 7 o'clock, I probably don't have your question, but I can assure you every question that you want asked is here. There's a lot of questions here, and we're going to do some popcorn, just throw it at them and just, you know, we're going to try to, you know, stomp the genius. So with that said, I'm going to remove this and bring Dr. Arthur Bradley in because it's all about you tonight. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. Good to see you, Forrest.
Good seeing you. So last time we spoke, I think we actually had dinner together.
We did. We sure did.
That was a little over a year and a half ago.
Yep.
And that was some of the guys we went with that still talk about that. And they remember like every detail to some of the questions they asked too. I'm like, did he answer that? And they go, yeah, he said this. And I'm like, okay. So good seeing you again. Thank you for coming on.
Sure. Happy to be here.
You're a little bit of a busy guy. I mean, I would think that NASA is a pretty demanding job.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm super busy right now for sure.
So if you don't mind, tell us about yourself and what you're doing and what's going on.
Sure. Yeah. So as you mentioned, I work at NASA during my day job. I'm the branch head and electronics branch there. And we do a lot of interesting work. We build satellites and we build instruments that go up to space station, and we're building something that's headed off actually on its way to Mars right now. So a lot of cool work. I mean, so I love that. That's my day job. After hours, I write books. I've written a number of nonfiction and fiction books. I do consulting for people on various EMP topics, typically. Teach at a local community college as well. I teach circuits for there. I have a family of 4 kids, so I'm always chasing kids around doing something. So stay very busy.
So let's talk about your books, because they're some of the best books written out there. So you have you and Glenn Tate kind of did the whole series of like 10 books. Don't you have, isn't it 10 books in your series or 11?
12.
12. 12. Okay, 12. Yeah. So tell us about your series that's been very popular, and it's been out for a while too.
Right. Yeah. The series is called The Survivalist. Mm-hmm. 12 books. Last one came out, I guess it was early this year or late last year. And it follows a U.S. Marshal around after a pandemic destroys the world. We're sort of living through some of that right now. It was a little premonition of mine. But so anyway, I've always had an interest in pandemics and, you know, viral pathogens and things. So I sort of wrote that into a story, and I made it an adventure story. Each book is very fast paced, very fun writing, very fun reading. But I also interweave some various survival tips and preparedness tips throughout it. I have 2 primary characters, which are very different characters. Sort of one is kind of the dark, rough side of all of us, right? We all have some of that in us. And the other person is sort of the honorable, noble lawman type person. And to be honest, there are two camps of people who read them. One really identify with one and others identify with the other. I think I'm a bit of both, which is probably why I wrote it that way. But it's a fun story. If you like good adventure stories, you know, people might check out The Survivalist. I know a lot of people have already read it, but it's pretty fun.
It's The Survivalist. You've been an engineer for 30 plus years too. I mean, you're not a newbie at this stuff. You've been through and I'm surprised though, you went pandemic instead of like EMP.
Yeah, I thought about that. There were a couple of good books already out on EMP preparedness. And, you know, they were sort of EMP stories. And I thought, well, I don't want to retell that story. Mm-hmm. And I'd been asked, I don't know how many years ago it was, on stage by somebody. I think it was at one of these big interviews I'd done. And they said, what are you most worried about? And I told them then, it was many years ago, the number one thing on my short list of worries is that there'll be a global pandemic. It happened. We have these every so often. And I thought, you know, that would make an interesting story. I'm thinking of like Stephen King's The Stand and things like that, but told in more of maybe a little bit lighter, funner adventure story. And so I decided to go down that route instead.
Gotcha. So did you foresee something that we didn't see?
I'm not that smart. No, I'm not that smart. But, you know, I have to say we were prepared for it. You know, to our credit, I was really happy. My family, we had, you know, already protective masks. We had a number of supplies that were really targeted toward some kind of, you know, epidemic of sorts. So we didn't have the last minute scramble that a lot of people did to try and find supplies. Yeah.
And so you've been a preparedness expert for years and you do a lot of consulting, not just for families, but also big companies that are putting data centers like underground and things.
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
yeah, I can't mention the companies. Of course, people like to keep that private. But I do I've consulted for a number of companies that are interested in, you know, protection from a variety of threats, EMP being one of them. And so they want to know that their facilities are properly protected from the radiated threat, the conducted threats. And it's really interesting work. It's lucrative work, too, because big companies have a lot of money. But they're really particular. You know, they want to know things are going to work and they want to know how you know it. But once you get on their short list of people, they trust you and they bring you in to check things out. And I've been brought in to verify other people's work before, which is flattering to me. It's nice that people trust my abilities in that way. But I enjoy that. I enjoy consulting quite a bit.
So I do a little consulting with like survival groups. It would really help me if I could say that I work for NASA.
Well, you're an honorary member, Forrest. How about that?
Okay. Do I get like a little badge or something?
Yeah, we can get you a little NASA sticker.
Okay. Great. Oh, a sticker. I don't even get it. Okay. Great. So I'm going to ask, some of these questions we have will kind of gear right to some of the products you have as well.
Okay.
And then if they don't, we'll talk about them as well. Or show us the little card, the neat little card that you have.
All right. Yeah. This is kind of unique. Let's see if I can get it on screen. This is a card called the Survivor Symbols card.
Mm-hmm.
On the front and back are a bunch of symbols. And it's an RFID protected card. So basically you put one in your wallet. It protects any of your wireless credit cards from being skimmed, right? And so you might have heard about that. A number of people have had that happen. They've written me and said, hey, you know, I really wish I had that card.
Right.
But basically someone comes in close contact to you, they can skim your credit card information and put it to, you know, nefarious uses. What I did is I used to sell the Vault card, which is a great product if somebody wants to look that up. I used to resell that, and I eventually thought, well, you know, I really want to put my own cool symbols on this card. The idea of the survivor symbols is these symbols that people could leave behind for others to tell them, you know, this water is safe or ammunition is nearby, or, you know, whatever kinds of messages you want to danger, you know, this area. And so I came up with this code and I wanted to put it on a card that people would have in their wallet. But I didn't just want it to be any old card. I wanted it to be a protective card. So I bought, I don't know, maybe 20 different RFID cards. And I tested them all to see which one was the best. And I picked the very best performing one. And then I had a bunch of these cards printed with the survivor symbols information on it. And they're just really cool. I mean, I really like it. It's probably one of the things I like most about all the stuff I sell, just because it's kind of unique.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's for security and there's a practical purpose for it today. Mm-hmm. And when the crap hits the fan.
Right. Exactly right. Yep.
Yep. Okay. Is that the hobo symbols on there that you have?
No, it's not the hobo symbols. That was actually what gave me the idea, though. The hobo code was you know, quite a while ago, maybe back in the 20s.
Okay.
It's not really relevant so much for like an emergency, you know, a situation where you're, you know, traveling across the country. It's a little bit of a different kind of code.
Okay.
Its code was more about, you know, people live here who might give me food, you know, stay away from here because police are called often, that kind of a thing, right? Whereas this code is more about, you know, what's safe and what's unsafe and what kind of dangers might be nearby, what kind of resources might be nearby, that kind of thing.
Gotcha. Okay. So without further ado, we're going to go into some questions, if you don't
mind. All right, bring them. I'll see what I can do.
So we had Denise, Robert, Sherry, Dawn, and Christopher ask this question. And I bet you've been asked this question 5,000 times in your life.
Okay.
And I'm going to just kind of read through some of the questions that are all kind of the same questions. And so I'm going to, there'll be like five questions here, but they're all the same question. Okay.
Right.
So will cars stop running? How can you be sure of a real impact of the EMP? Some say that cars will still work. Are cars before the 80s good? What percentage of cars will work after EMP hits? Mm-hmm. Are there any vehicles that will function better than others after the EMP? And can I shield my vehicle from an EMP?
All right. So the disappointing answer is nobody's exactly sure of most of those answers. I can give you educated guesses. I can tell you what we know. Yes, there's a belief that older cars probably would do better than newer cars because they have fewer microprocessors in them. They're just not as, if you know about electronics, the more modern the electronics, the smaller the devices are, and those are more susceptible to high voltages and things. So I think it's a reasonable assumption that older cars would survive better than newer cars. But I don't know that you could go model by model and say any 1973 car would out-survive a 2020. I don't think that's a fair statement because it would depend on the particular make and shape of the vehicle, how the cables were run, where the processors are at, what kind of, you know, some protections are in the car. There were a number of tests run by the EMP Commission. Everybody probably already knows this, but they tested around 50 cars. And while the tests were believed to be kind of flawed, and I won't, essentially what they did is they didn't want to blow up all the cars. And so they tested them to where they started getting anomalies. And then they said, okay, that's an anomaly. But they didn't take them all to the maximum levels. Once they saw anomalies, they stopped.
Okay.
And so people criticized that testing and saying, well, we don't really know then how many would have been damaged, right? We only know that there were a number of anomalies seen. And so the short answer is nobody knows what percentage of vehicles will fail. What is pretty certain is that if your vehicle is operating when an EMP occurred, you will very likely have some kind of an anomaly, right? Maybe 70% of cars will experience some kind of anomaly. So that might be your dashboard goes haywire. That might be your brakes kick on. Who knows, right? With modern cars, there's a lot of things that could go wrong. Let's hope it's not your airbag deploys or something like that.
Oh.
But, right, that'd be a danger. But so you, there would be some anomaly. The expectation is that if you could weather that anomaly and get to the side of the road and shut the car off and try the start again, many cars would probably correct themselves and restart. That's the belief, all right? I don't know that anyone knows that for certain, but that's kind of the belief. Some percentage of cars, again, not known the percentage, let's just throw a number out. Let's say 10% of cars would not recover from the anomaly. You wouldn't be able to restart the car because you've damaged something, you've overvoltaged something. And even if that number, which I think is a reasonably good guess, were true, you could imagine a case where, you know, 100 million cars out at any given time, 10% of the cars that are out suddenly are unable to operate. It's a lot of vehicles, right, that all of a sudden are going to be clogging up, causing accidents, just mayhem everywhere. So even if a small percentage of vehicles were the ones that were damaged to a point where you couldn't drive them, I think the impact would be tremendous, all right? I know in the stories, it's always, you know, every car stops working
right,
except for some guy's old Dodge that's in the shed. And that's fun stories. I doubt that's reality, but the reality is still going to be pretty stark, I think, in terms of transportation. And there's a number of things that fold into impacting that as well, like availability of fuel and stoplights being out and lots of other things that could impact it too. But just in terms of cars, that's kind of the short answer that I know.
Well, I heard Teslas will be free at that time.
Teslas will be free. It might be. I would love to have a Tesla, but it would not be what I would probably want to be driving during the EMP. Now, as far as protecting them, you know, if you're driving a car and I don't know of a way to protect it that makes any sense to me, All right. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is cars contain hundreds, if not thousands, of small microcontrollers and processors in it. And you can imagine the complexity of trying to design a system that would protect all of those things, right? And they're interconnected by hundreds of feet of cabling of all complexity. It's like an engineer's nightmare to try and protect something like that from a large radiated pulse. So I don't know of a way to do it short of an engineer taking that on, going, okay, that one vehicle, I'm going to solve this problem by putting devices here, 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 you know. And it would be a very, very expensive process to solve for a single vehicle. So I don't know how you protect moving vehicles. Don't drag a chain behind the car. I've seen that. People saying, oh, I'll be grounded. I'll be okay. That won't help you at all. Now, if the vehicle's not running, it's less likely it would be damaged anyway because the car's not as energetic. It could still be. I'm not saying it wouldn't be, but it's less likely. And the only way I know to protect vehicles that are not running is to cover them with something conductive. So it could be a big metal building that you seal up real well. It could be I sell a conductive cold pump. It's the only thing I could think of to use. It's expensive, and I only recommend it for people who are really serious about dipping it. But you basically make a car cover over it, and you have this big conductive car cover hanging over your car that drapes down on the concrete. And it does a reasonably good job of reducing the field. 27% of the fields are reduced. And I'm confident that's enough to help it survive. But that's the only way I really know to protect vehicles from EMP.
Go. Okay, great. Awesome. So the next question is by Sherry and David. What flaws do we have in some of the government testing that we do about EMPs? I mean, are they accurate? And have there been any improvements on our infrastructure at all in the last few years?
Hey, let's take a quick break.
Has your data been hacked? Do you feel uneasy about the vulnerability of your personal information online? Were you involved in the Target, LinkedIn, or Microsoft data leaks? Don't know? If not, then pay attention. Join Forrest Garvin from PrepperNet for a free webinar on privacy and security. Gain insights into safe internet browsing, VPNs, crafting online aliases, secure emails, detecting if your data has been hacked, and managing passwords. Secure your spot today for this webinar on privacy and security. It's free. This webinar delves into comprehensive strategies for bolstering your online privacy. We've got you covered, from fortifying your passwords to shielding your financial information and mastering state-of-the-art encryption techniques. We're offering two convenient dates to suit your schedule. Reserve your spot now at preppernet.com/privacy. Don't let cyber threats erode your peace of mind any longer. Take the first step toward a safer, more secure online experience by joining us for our free webinar. Remember, knowledge is power when it comes to safeguarding your privacy. Sign up now at preppernet.com/privacy. We'll see you there.
Yeah, it's a good question and it's hard to answer. I've been privileged to read some of the briefings and reports that go to pretty high levels in the government. They weren't classified, so I'm not breaking any classified rules or anything, but I at least got to see where the thinking was. And the thinking is not toward real-world testing, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. It's all about simulation now. All of the talk of investment in EMP preparedness that projects and companies are putting forward is about creating these simulators, these very complex simulators to do it. You might know back, I guess it's been 30 years ago or more, maybe 40 years ago, there used to be a big system called the trestle, which was a big wooden structure. I got a picture in my book. In fact, the girl who let me use it, her father used to work at the trestle, and was kind of cool, took the original picture of that. And anyway, it was a big wooden structure. Even the bolts were wooden. Everything was wooden because you didn't want to interfere with the fields. And they did real-world EMP testing on military aircraft and vehicles. We don't have that capability anymore. It's all done by simulation. And simulators are quite good, but it is what it is. I do think there is energy behind trying to make the nation a bit more resistant and protected against that threat. I do see it. I just think we're at the infancy of it right now. And I know President Trump, whether you love him or hate him, you know, he did sign essentially an executive order saying this is a threat we should take a look at. And there's been some movement about that recently. There was a status update that came out just recently. So there is some attention being turned to it. I do know that some of the elements within the grid, if you will, are looking at EMP preparedness, and they've implemented some protective measures. I've been told that by people who work for various pieces of these companies that support the grid. but I don't know the details. I don't even know if they're would be allowed to ever release that information from, you know, for sensitivity reasons. You don't want your enemy to know what you've done. But I do think there's some movements to try and protect the grid. But I don't want to give you the wrong impression. I don't think we're anywhere near fully protected or anything like that.
Right. So with that said, we're both in a documentary that one day is going to come out.
We hope so.
We don't know if we're going to get cut out of it or not. Right. We were both interviewed.
Yeah.
Because we haven't seen it yet.
Right.
And it's called the Black Sky Event. Mm-hmm. And so you guys can look that up on Facebook, or they have a website as well. It's called the Black Sky Event. I'm interviewed in it. I know you're interviewed in it. And so I think it's supposed to come out this fall. So it's, I mean, that's right around the corner. So, okay, great question. Great answers there. So the next question is, well, one of my city leaders is just yelling at me in all capital letters about a small vehicle, electric bike or scooter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're doing a scooter and you're trying to bug out on a scooter, I don't know. But electric bike is, I mean, would you have to protect that, you think?
Yeah, I think if it were me and I had a scooter or an electric bike, the charging systems on those things are pretty sophisticated, right? And so I think I would put something over it. And I know a number of people have either built enclosures or bought cloth to put over their electric bikes and scooters because they figure, worst comes to worst, I may not be able to get fuel anyway. And having something that was either electric or very fuel efficient, or at least gave me a little bit of juice when I'm trying to get away, might be useful, or get around to get supplies. I would think that you'd need to assume it was vulnerable and you'd want to do something to help protect it.
So, and another simple question, you've never been asked this ever. What's the best practical way to protect small electronics, ham radios, you know, shortwave radios? What's the best way? And are the ones that I know you have some good videos on your YouTube channel, and you're like in this underground bunker, it looks like. I remember making fun of you last time, like this door with a big handle and stuff. And like someone locked you in there. But so, and you demonstrate and build a Faraday cage. Will that really work? And then tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. There's a number of options. People have come up with some pretty clever ways. Common ones are things like big metal galvanized garbage cans. You know, if you can put a gasket around, I have a video on this. You can put a conductive gasket around the lid and you put the lid on it. It does a fantastic job shielding things. So it's a very inexpensive way to have a Faraday cage. You can get the EMP bags. I've evaluated a whole bunch of different ones. I've got some on my website for sale. They're really inexpensive, handfuls of dollars for a bag. And you just stuff your items in it, roll up the top, tape it up. If it's stuff you don't need very often, that's a very nice way to do it. If you need to take it in and out every day, it's nicer to have like that garbage can or something that you can easily remove lids and get in and out. People have used ammo cans. I mean, there's a lot of cleverness. If you have a fully sealed conductive box of any shape and any sort, it will do an excellent job shielding. It doesn't have to be very thick either. You can make one out of aluminum foil. We did back when I was down there for the last convention, we built Faraday cages out of plastic tubs and aluminum foil. And what we found is we could get about 50 dB of shielding, which is about 99.7%, right? What was interesting is without having a way to test it, it was really hard to look at one box versus the other box and know which one was the fantastic one and which one was not so great. And we learned that the hard way. And I told people all along, and it's true, you always have to pay attention to the seams, like the lid, right, around the seam of the lid. And those who did that when they built those tubs, they worked great. And then the ones that maybe got a little sloppy about that, they did awful. And it was just based on that seam. So whatever you do, whether you have a filing cabinet or an old gun safe or whatever you're going to use, it's not the thickness of the metal that matters. And it's not the little holes that matter. You can actually take a drill and drill holes in your Faraday cage. It'll make almost no difference. What matters is any long seam, any narrow long seam will just greatly compromise the Faraday cage. So people think about that when you're building something up. If you got little bitty holes, don't freak out about it. But if you got, you know, a long narrow slot, that's probably going to not work very well.
Okay. This isn't one of the questions, but how would someone at home test to see if they're there? Because I remember you guys had plastic tubs. You put tinfoil around it, put it on the lid. And shut it, and you go, there you go. And people are like, going, really? That's plastic and tinfoil. And you're like, that's all it takes. So how would they test? What's a good measure of testing?
Yeah, it's difficult to test at home because here's what happens is people will buy an EMP bag, which they're very good bags, and they'll stuff their cell phone in it and tape it up, and they'll call their cell phone, and the cell phone will ring. Not all the time, but most of the time it'll ring. And they'll go, oh, this thing's a piece of junk. It won't even block my cell phone. How's it going to protect against EMP? The difference is that things like two-way radios and cell phones, they may take like 100 dB of shielding to block. They're meant to pick up really, really tiny signals, right? And so it's difficult to fully shut them off where you can't receive a signal. It takes around 100 dB for cell phones, maybe a little less, and about 120 dB for two-way radios. So you just, to block them is really, really hard. So they're not good tests for Faraday cages because they're just too robust. You can use like AM/FM radios, and sometimes that will, at least it'll give you a read, right? If you put your radio in there, sometimes even without the lid on, the signal will start going out on you and you'll realize, yeah, I've got a lot of protection here. But there's not a great way to go, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down on this particular unit here, because what you really need, and when I came to the convention, you know, I brought a spectrum analyzer with me and I brought a transmitter. Mm-hmm. And I transmitted energy at the box and I put the spectrum analyzer inside and then I could read how much energy it was receiving. And that's the only effective way to know what the shielding is. And people pay a lot of money, pay me a lot of money to go out and check their facilities because you really have to sweep across all the frequencies and you have to measure, you know, what the worst case shielding is. So I don't know of a great way for people to do it at home.
So they you just have to trust the science. It's not great. You just got to trust the science behind it.
Yeah. If you follow the guidelines that I maybe and others have put out about making a Faraday cage, like let's say the garbage can one, if you put the gasket in and you get a good seal of that lid, that can will provide excellent shielding. If you use an EMP bag and you tape it up, it will provide a good shielding.
Also, the ammo can, though, you probably need to take the rubber gasket out. Wouldn't you suggest that?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, and I tested those there on one of the videos I have. There's a plus and a minus to that. The plus is if you take out the rubber gasket, it'll never go back in. So don't even fool yourself.
Okay.
I'll tell you right now.
Okay.
But then you stick in this gasketing, and I sell this gasket, I'm gonna say. But you put this gasketing in, and you close it up, and it does a fantastic job. It does like 80 dB of shielding, 99.99%. So really, really good. The disadvantage is you've lost the waterproof nature of your can, and some people don't like that.
Right.
So it depends on what you're storing and whether you're worried about that threat or not. If you are worried about it, maybe you put something water, you put your items in something waterproof before you put them in the 30 cake.
Okay.
Yeah, it does great.
So I don't know the questions are, and I don't know who asked them. Well, maybe we can. I know we had a lot of people ask about microwave ovens and also container, shipping containers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I've looked at both of those. So microwave ovens do an okay job of protecting things. Not great, not as good as an EMP bag or your galvanized garbage can, but an okay job. If you had they're just not designed for the frequencies of the EMP, right? And so if you put some things in an old microwave and close them up, great, you've got some protection there. But I don't want you to think that, oh, that's much better than if I built a Faraday cage, because it wouldn't actually be as good. Now, shipping containers, we tested one last summer. I put a video on YouTube for that too.
What's your YouTube channel so everybody will know?
Disaster Prepper.
Disaster Prepper.
Disaster Prepper. Yep.
Yeah, don't go mail people, but go after the show because there's too good of information here. So.
Yep. Yep. So we did a test. I had a student for the summer and we decided we were going to go and check out many times I've been asked about shipping containers. So we set up, I got inside of the shipping container. We set up the antennas. We did the checks. And what we found is it provided modest protections. Not great, along the order of 20 dB. And the reason was quite simple. It's the huge seam around the outside of the doors, right, and down the middle of the door. Now, there are ways around that. Like, for example, you could use a conductive curtain just inside of the door. You could buy conductive cloth and create a conductive curtain. And I think then it would do quite well. But all in all, it gives you modest protection, better than nothing for sure, but not enough that by itself anything in there would be guaranteed to survive.
Okay. Awesome. Next question is, Denise, Nicholas, Kobe, Glenn Tate even asked the question about How about these little devices that you can buy for your home or for your car?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, yeah. So what they are is they're surge protection devices, right? Mm-hmm. And they're pretty much all of them, if you look, at least especially for the home. Talk about the home. They're all type 2 surge protection devices is what they are. And type 2 refers to the fact that it's not out at the, you know, at the service entrance outside your home, but it's actually inside past the meter. And it's not a type 3, which is down in your house where you plug things into. Type 2 is sort of in the middle at your breaker panel. And the short, I looked into this a lot. People may know I was developing a product that was going to be a little unique, a little bit different. The idea of my product was that not only would it shunt away the energy of a surge, but when you got a long duration surge, it would actually try and trip the house breaker. And that would disconnect you from the source of the noise, at least the conductive noise. But that product's not exactly out, so we won't talk about that. The short answer is that I think surge protection devices do protect homes from a number of threats. I have one on my own, all right?
Okay.
I have a Siemens FS-140. That's the product I recommend. I don't sell it. I don't get a nickel for recommending it. Siemens doesn't even know I exist. But I took apart, I guess, about 15 surge protectors, all of the good ones you could think of. Uh-huh. And I looked at them, and some were very good, some were okay, some were not so good. But the Siemens FS-140 was the best by far. It had the 140 refers to its surge current rate, which is 140,000 amps, much more than most surge protectors have. And if you take it apart and you look at it, it just has bank after bank after bank of these protective varistors in it. So it can shunt a lot of energy, and it's the product I like. I think it does a very good job of protecting against E2. Of an EMP. An E2 is kind of like a lightning strike. That's what these are designed for. So it does a very good job of that. Now, well, there's an E1 and an E3. What do you do about those? Well, E1 is a very, very high frequency pulse, right? We're talking like a couple of nanoseconds up, then a few nanoseconds wide and a couple of nanoseconds down. So what you have to do to catch that on a power line is you have to bring it down and you have to spread it out. It's your only hope. The surge protectors are just not fast enough to turn on in a couple of nanoseconds. Right now, I'll just leave it at that. They're just not. And so what you have to do is you have to bring that pulse down and spread it out. And the way you do that is you have to put some custom ferrites around those incoming power wires coming into the home. Their whole job really is to do just that. Take that really sharp E1 pulse and spread it out a little bit lower. That gives the surge protector time to turn on, shunt away most of that energy. Then comes the E2. It's built for that. It's beautiful. It'll shunt that away. If you're lucky, then in comes in E3, which is a long duration, lower voltage pulse. Assuming it doesn't take out the transformers and stuff like that and it makes it to your home, your best bet is if you have a really beefy surge protector like the Siemens, it will turn on and it will try and shunt massive amounts of energy. Now, one of two things will happen. It'll either explode and burn up, which will be exciting, or it will in fact trip the home breaker. All right.
Next I know for a fact, explode in your house, in your garage.
Well, it's not in the garage, right?
Okay.
If you are fortunate, it'll trip your brake. It's almost like the idea I had. It's not quite a crowbar, which is what I was doing, but it is basically a really big short to ground, and it'll try and trip the breaker. It'll pull 100,000 amps very quickly. So maybe, just maybe, it would block the E3, but there's no guarantee of that. So that's my answer of the home protection is, the way I have on my, if I go down to open my breaker panel, you'll see a big Siemens FS-140 in there, and you'll see three of these whole house ferrites. And I sell those, and I'm not just pitching them because I sell them, I believe in them. And again, they're to help with the E1 pulse. That's what I got on my house. I think it's as good as you can do for hundreds of dollars, all right, for hundreds of dollars. The Siemens product's about $180, very good investment. Mm-hmm. The ferrites are about $150, I think a reasonable investment. So for a few $100, you got something, right? Now, if you got big dollars, and I'm working with some clients that have big dollars, I don't tell them to put a Siemens on their house. I tell them, we need to go buy you an EMP filter. And they make such things that you can put on a house. They're about 6 foot long, and they're about 2 feet wide and 2 feet deep, and they cost maybe about $40,000. So if you got big dollars, there is definite protections you can put on that will do a fantastic job. But for most of us, I don't have $40,000 laying around to go do that. And so for the reasonable, you know, compromise, I think spending a few $100 on that surge protector and some ferrites is a good preparation. So for home, that's what I've got. The other thing I'd advise on home use is get some small broadband ferrites and put them at the point of load. So if you have a sensitive radio or sensitive Go ahead.
Show them what a ferrite is. Don't you have one, Landon?
So this is one of the whole house custom ferrites here. And there's no magic to it. I did a video on how they're made. You probably can't see, but the interior of them has a shiny surface on them here. Uh-huh. And that's actually what makes it kind of special. You have to calculate a very, very precise barrier distance that you need between the clamp of the ferrite. And if you can implement that to within about a thousandth of an inch, you can get a pretty good high saturation ferrite. That's what these are. For your home ones, for like your computer, for your radios and stuff, you can just buy broadband ferrites. I got a number on my website, but you can find them yourself, lots of places. And you can clip them around your power cords, and they do a reasonable job of catching the energy that comes into the house wires and might propagate up into your products. So I do kind of three steps. I buy a Siemens surge protector, I put on my whole house ferrites, and then I use these small broadband ferrites at the actual devices in my home. I think that's a reasonable precautions people can take to try and protect their electronics.
Okay.
Now, the car one's a little different one. I kind of mentioned before, maybe it was off the air.
It was.
I don't know of a way to protect a vehicle other than to cover it with something conductive.
So that brings up a question. A lot of people are asking, none of these Faraday cages need to be grounded, correct?
Right. That's probably the question I get asked the most of all.
Yeah. They don't need to be grounded. They just need to be solid.
Right. And the confusion comes because there's lots of reasons we have Faraday cages. Like if I go to my shield room at work and it's a giant Faraday cage, it is grounded. But the reason things that are grounded like that is they're trying to shunt away energy. Like let's say there's a lightning strike or a discharge, a static discharge, something like that. They're trying to discharge that energy away. And so you do want to have grounded. That's why we have grounding rods and houses connected to grounding rods and stuff. But when you're trying to protect small electronics from very high frequency energy, you really just need a conductive shell. It doesn't have to be grounded. It doesn't hurt to be grounded, but it doesn't have to be. And it doesn't really help anything either. I've done a number of tests and I showed reattach a ground, doesn't make any difference, take off the ground.
Okay. How about small electronics, phones, watches, pacemakers? Are people with pacemakers just going to die?
I'm going to croak. Yeah. You know, it's a great question. I had a doctor ask me that. Must have been about a year and a half or 2 years ago. And I told him I didn't know, but I wanted to know. And so he actually wrote Medtronic, which was a manufacturer of them, one of the major ones. And they sent him the susceptibility data for their product, which was really cool because now I had real data. And I wrote a little white paper. It's like 2 pages or so. And I sent it to a couple of different online groups. And I basically analyzed, what if an EMP went right overhead, right? You got the worst case fields. Would your pacemaker be destroyed? And the short answer was, based on the Medtronic's data, no, it would not. It would have survived the EMP. It might have experienced a reset. You might have to go in and get it adjusted, but it would not have been damaged and the person wouldn't have died on the spot. And so based on that, you know, again, sample size of one, I only had one product to look at. I was very encouraged that they might in fact survive without any problem.
Okay.
Now, cell phones and watches, I wouldn't bet on your cell phone. Anything with an antenna is very likely to be damaged by an EMP. Your watch, unfortunately, now all of our smartwatches have all these antennas in them too.
Right.
So my guess is, even though they're very small and their trace lengths are very small, in them, they have antennas. And what's the job of an antenna? Bring in high frequency energy, amplify it, make it where you can use it. An EMP is just a whole bunch of high frequency energy that's going to come right in the front end.
What if it's off?
I don't think it'll make much difference. The antenna is still there. You'll still turn on the gates. Yeah. I think you'd very likely destroy both cell phones and smartwatches.
Wow, this is awesome. I mean, you're answering like every question. So how about solar panels, converters, and batteries? Because people are off the grid or have a solar generator.
Yeah.
And something I want to know is that, from my understanding, a solar panel is nothing more than a diode.
A whole bunch of them.
A whole bunch of them. So isn't it the diodes in a lot of the circuits that what fries the circuits because of EMP? So would solar panels, in a sense, go boop, not work anymore?
Yeah, it doesn't look like that. The reason that it's different is the photovoltaic cells in a solar panel are very robust. They're meant for high currents to go through them. And the only company I know of, I won't mention the company. They asked me not to. There's a company who makes EMP hardened solar power generation systems. You can look them up and find it. And
can I mention it if I know it?
What's that? Yeah, you can answer. I just got told them I wouldn't.
Is it Solark?
Could very well be.
Okay.
And so a company makes them, and they were kind enough to give me an interview, and I asked them these questions, and they said that when they tested standalone solar panels, no cables attached, the solar panels were not damaged. Right? And they tested many, many EMP pulses, right, in a simulator, right? And I'm talking about real generating pulses simulator. And so that was really encouraging. And that's the information I share with people, is that if your solar panels are freestanding, no, nothing attached to them, they're very likely going to survive.
Okay. Based
on that data. Now, what they did share with me is as soon as they connected up the cables and they got the whole system together, now all of a sudden lots of stuff got damaged, right, including the panels. And so you do have to take some protective measures to protect your solar power generation system. I do a whole video on that. There's a number of steps. The short of it is you want to put ferrites at both ends of the long run of wires that go between the panels and the inverter. And you want to put a good surge protection device at the inverter. And you want to use ferrites going from the power up in from the inverter up into the panel of your house. So there's a number of ferrites you can use, as well as a surge protector, and that can help protect your solar power generation system. It's not 100%. It's not tested like that company's products where they, you know, they do zap things. But I will say this about EMP testing. It's a tricky business because we have simulators that can generate the pulse, right? The radiated pulse. I'm not aware of anybody that has a simulator that can generate the conductive pulse. You'd have to have a huge power bank to be able to generate something like that. And I don't know what testing are done when people, you know, do EMP testing, but my understanding is it's usually this big radiated flash pulse, which is really neat, but it's not the same as exactly a real world EMP. So, you know, the short answer is I don't know that it's 100% any protections you put on your solar, but I do think there's a lot of protections you can do. And I think your chances of it surviving go way up by doing that. Batteries are sort of the same way. Freestanding batteries of any sort, as long as they don't have charge controllers in them, are not going to be damaged by an EMP. I'm not aware of any that would be. But as soon as you hook up cables to them and there's a lot of current that could be flowing, they could be. So again, putting some ferrites around the battery leads would make sense. Now, the only thing to know about anytime you put ferrites on, if you put a ferrite around the whole bundle of wires, it protects against any common surge that comes down the wires, right? So like an EMP might send a common surge down the wire. So if you can clip around both wires, you can address that common surge, and that's what you want to do. In some cases, though, like for your home, you know, you've got these big 4-aught gauge wires coming in feeding your breaker panel, right? 200 amp breakers on your panel. And there's no way you're going to put a ferrite around that whole bundle of those 3 or 4 wires. And so you have to put one around each wire. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, normal ferrites will not do much for you. They'll just saturate from the current. Ferrites are not meant to have a low frequency current through them. They just saturate themselves. And so they won't provide protection. And so that's why these custom whole house ones that I've got, that's why they're unique, is they're designed for a lot of steady state current before they saturate. All right. So the short answer is if you use ferrites, go around the whole bundle if you can. If it's for big power wires that you can't do that, you'll have to put these high saturation ferrites for them to do you much good.
So do you know anyone that does consulting on that?
I do a bit on that. And
okay.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny lately, I guess, because the election and the EMP threat with the recent report that came out, people took that very seriously. I've had a lot of people call me, even for just half an hour, you know, $100 kind of thing, right? They just want to sit down for half an hour and go, hey, am I doing this right?
Right.
And we'll talk on the phone for a little bit and make sure that they're getting, and they'll send me some photos to look at and that kind of stuff. I think it's pretty reasonable. I mean, I hire people when I don't know what I'm doing. I ask them, I don't want to make mistakes. And I've been busy doing that kind of stuff.
Okay. Yeah. And you know what? Let's be honest. You talk like a real human being too. Not like some NASA scientist using formulas and doing getting to the chalkboard and stuff. So, I mean, so people can understand what you're saying.
Well, I appreciate that.
Okay, some more questions here. We already asked that one. The inverter, though, you would think would be gone, toast, right?
If it's not protected, it would be. If you have a surge protection device on and the ferrites, I think it could very well survive.
Okay. Then another person says, why aren't there any, this is Joshua, why aren't there an agency, private or public, that... that, you know, test this stuff to let us know this stuff. Is it the cost? Maybe me and you could build one. I like that you said some kind of explosion. I'm like, let's do that. I like explosions.
Yeah, I like blowing stuff up too. one of the most fun I had was trying to trip breakers in my house through basically drawing 50,000 amps at a time through shorts. That's a lot of fun. Your wife will get really nervous when you get these big explosions like that. But yeah, the short answer is there are some small groups that that have formed that are looking at EMP preparedness. I get contacted from them every so often. You know, they ask me to look at something or to talk to some of their folks and stuff. There is some attention to it. I just don't think it's quite gotten, full attention yet. It's still a little bit of a fringe interest. Of course, when it's going to get a lot of interest is when one happens. And then, of course, the whole world's going to know about it.
How about LED flashlights?
LED flashlights, yeah, they probably could be damaged by an EMP. The short answer is on one side, they're often in metal enclosures, metal tubes, a lot of times are aluminum. And that helps reduce the fields. But there are some wires and there are LEDs and the bulbs could certainly be blown. And so I think they could be susceptible. I put mine in a Faraday cage. I put a spare set.
Okay. We're doing good here. Doing good on time. When we read the books about an EMP hitting the United States, let's say it's a nuclear bomb exploded over the United States. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much line of sight. Mm-hmm. We know.
Yep.
And also, I know one of your jobs is to protect satellites. And I have a friend. He's my Asheville city leader. He wants to know if his sat phone will still work after EMP. If he has it protected on Earth,
right,
would the satellite still work?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I will say the satellites could certainly be damaged. There's been a number of studies and simulations that have looked at that. And there's certainly some susceptibility of satellites. Now, whether his uses a redundant network where there's something on either side of the planet and it might rotate back around, he might be okay. And same way with GPS satellites, there's a whole redundant network up there.
Right.
So you probably wouldn't lose all functionality of that kind of service. But I would expect there would be some satellites that would be damaged.
Okay. And then back to the other question of that, the first part of that, which was line of sight down. I guess it depends on how high it is.
Yep, that's right.
And so you couldn't cover the entire United States, could you?
You can almost cover it. You can almost cover the continental United States with a single explosion. It's pretty close. Yeah, so if you get 100 miles up or so, you can cover most of the United States with it. The chances are, what people think they might happen, though, is you might would detonate one over a very densely populated area, maybe the eastern seaboard, and one over, let's say, California or something like that, and one over the central U.S. If you could do something like that, even if it was, staged in time a little bit, you could cause a lot of problems. I mean, tremendous amount of financial damage to the country, if nothing else.
And I know you know the answer, and that's why I'm going to ask this question, because I tell people this all the time, and they look at me like, you don't know what you're talking about. But in the EMP Commission report, which I'm sure you're familiar with, mm-hmm, they state that if an EMP hit the United States, they state in there, they predict what percentage of people would die in the United States. Mm-hmm. Do you know that number?
I think it's 90% or something like that.
Yeah, and I tell people that, and they look at me like they just can't comprehend that.
Yeah.
Their own government says that 90% of the people in America would die if an EMP hit us.
I don't buy it, just to be fair. It is true that's what they say. I don't buy it because people are really, people like you and me, Forrest, I'm not going to die from it. I'm going to be out there fighting and figuring out how to stay alive. There's a lot of people like that frankly will pick themselves up and figure out that I'm in a really bad situation. How do I make it through this? And it's only for probably a year, right? Worst case, yeah, in a year, things are going to kind of get righted in some sense. And there'll be a number of people who figure that out. Now, there'll be a number of people who don't, right, who won't figure out how to get clean water, and they'll die of whatever diseases you want to name, or dehydration, or, malnourishment, or whatever. So there would be a lot of chaos and a lot of death and destruction. I don't in any way want to minimize it. I just want to believe that we as Americans, and I'm a patriot, I just believe a lot of people would band together and figure out how to weather it and survive it. So I don't know that. I just think that number's a little high, but I don't want to oversell that we're all that great either, because I think there'd be a lot of people who suffer.
I would hope you're correct, but to be honest with you, my old friends and the people I know, they're they're clueless. I just don't have that kind of hope. But anyway,
Yeah. So, no, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a funny story. My mother one time had power go out, and she was staying at house sitting at a friend's house, and they had no electricity, nothing like that. And she said, I'll be fine. I had to go on a trip. And so I had to leave my mother, who was probably in her 60s then, by herself. I came back 2 weeks later. They still had no power. She'd been living with building a fire in the fire pit and cooking her own food and everything else. I thought, you know, there's hope for this world yet. You know, she could survive. So it was pretty impressive.
Okay. Next question. So with some of the reports that have come out here recently about EMP and EMP threats, when you wrote the book, you thought the most likely scenario would be pandemic. Has any of that wavered here recently, and your threat level of EMP? What is your percentage of kind of most likely thing to happen? Is EMP kind of high or not really?
Well, so these are all high impact, low frequency events. So they're all unlikely, right? Even a pandemic's unlikely, even though we're living.
Right.
But it's the first one in my lifetime that's been this significant, right? But I do think the EMP threat has moved up the scale of probability. We've had a number of overt threats. North Koreans have made one. Others have made threats. Russians have certainly said that before. Mm-hmm. The Chinese have hinted that, hey, you know, a couple of well-placed EMP attacks, we could disable a lot of your infrastructure. So it's an attack known not only by us, but by our enemies. I think it's a reasonable thing that we could expect during if we were in some kind of engagement. And it's an asymmetric attack, right? It's an attack that people could administer on the U.S. and not expect the full nuclear retaliation, right? We might not even know who did it for a long period of time. And by then, you know, it's not like you just blew up Los Angeles. You, in fact, you disabled a number of things. You caused a lot of hardship. You cost a lot of money. But does that really lead to nuclear war? Probably not. And so I think it's probably moved up the list of possible attacks on the United States, personally.
Mm-hmm. Someone had a question I saw earlier. I don't know. I'll just keep going on my list here. We already covered the satellites, microwaves we covered. Does the EMP affect your body at all?
No. Now, the burst is so short in time that you don't end up with any cellular damage that we know of.
Okay. What about 5G, ham radio antennas? You know, but 5G is going to kill us all.
Yeah, 5G is going to kill us all.
And actually, I know you probably know a lot about 5G. Is there a secret hidden weapon in there that's going to kill us?
No, I don't think so. There are, to be fair, there okay. are some uncertainties with 5G about its effects on human bodies, right? Because, and we could talk about 5G for 30 minutes, but the short of it is, they have to have a lot of antennas for 5G. They have to be like every 100 meters or something, because it's very easy to attenuate that very high frequency. We're talking about tens of gigahertz of frequency. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have lots of them around, right? And people are worried about being constantly bombarded by those frequencies, very high frequencies. And I think the verdict is still out whether there could be some harmful effects. I'm not a person that's out saying, oh, 5G, burn the towers or anything like that. But I do think that waving it away entirely is 100% safe. Probably a little premature, but I don't think it's a weaponized thing in any sort.
Okay. How about antenna, cell phone networks, ham radio repeaters? You would think that's all toast because they have antennas.
Yeah, those are the things most likely to be damaged.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll just say right now, if you have teenagers, you better put some cell phones that have games in a Faraday cage, or your life's going to be miserable.
Yeah.
Afterwards. So let's see. So Trump did pass that bill to do research, but have we not done like research for 40 years on this? We know what it's going to do. And
yeah.
I mean, well, when's the action? Is it the reason their lack of action? So the movie that we're in or the documentary is to get people to act on this, but mm-hmm. They pretty much know where we are, but all the energy companies are private companies, and it's hard for the government to enforce them or make them protect the grid, isn't it?
Yeah, right. You know, there's the five major interconnects across the U.S., and there's all of these different entities supporting those interconnects. So there's not like a central, it's not like a government-run entity that we can go, well, you shall do this, right? Mm-hmm. There will be, have to be a lot of arrangements and deals and partnerships. And the first step, I think, is where we're at, which is to look at the threat, to decide where, and I mean, the grid is the thing, right? If you were going to protect one thing, you protect the grid, because it's the lifeblood to all of our infrastructure, right? You take the grid out, everything collapses very quickly.
Right.
And so they do need to look at that. I think they are looking at that to some degree, but it's certainly not been public knowledge that we're doing a lot of hardening on the grid.
Okay. Now, this is my nerd friend from Columbia, South Carolina. Good guy, smart guy. Hmm. And how much attenuation is needed to negate the effect of a E1, E2, and E3 pulse?
Right.
Do you understand that?
Yeah, attenuation just means how much you've reduced the energy by, right? The, let's say the field level by. So when I was saying things like an EMP bag will provide 50 dB of attenuation, that means it'll reduce it by 50 dB. What's a dB? Well, it's a ratio, but 50 dB is reducing it by 99.7%, the field, the let's say electric field. And the number I throw out is 50 dB. That's the number I've always told people. If you can get 50 dB of shielding across frequency, almost any electronics I know of would survive. All right. Now, the government in MIL standard 188-125 calls for 80 dB of shielding, which is 99.99%. But again, they're protecting military hardware with, you know, you have to have margins in top of margins. But for people, I think 50 dB is a reasonable number. And that number is not true for E3, but it is true for E1 and E2. E3 is a much, much lower value voltage that would come along the lines. You can't protect from it versus a, with a Faraday cage, and you don't need to because it won't affect small electronics. And E3 is a very long wavelength energy pulse. And it won't affect your radio. It won't affect your cell phone. It's only E1 and E2 that you have issues, perhaps, with those portable devices.
Okay. And to follow up, he's got some more questions. But even the thinnest sheet of aluminum foil, if properly sealed, will protect something, correct?
Almost.
Almost.
Yeah, okay. If you run the numbers, there's something called the skin depth of the metal.
Okay.
And you want to make sure you're several skin depths deep. And if you run the numbers, if you get heavy duty aluminum foil, it's just about the right amount to have a minimum thickness. So if you want to do it a little better, you put it in two layers of heavy duty aluminum foil. But don't buy the cheapo, you know, Food Lion brand that's really thin and think, okay, one little thin layer of that, I'm good. It's not quite thick enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
So someone also mentioned, and I want to know if this is real. I've seen a video online, and I think it's called Champ. And it is done by Boeing. And it's actually a drone that can be sent that can EMP shock one building at a time, send a pulse down. Mm-hmm. And the video, all the computers go off. They're old computers. Mm-hmm. Because they're like, and is that device real?
And if it, I don't know if that, yeah, if that particular device is, but there are certainly weapons like that and have been for some time where they can have small scale EMP type devices. Absolutely. I don't know that's the ones to fear because, of course, those are going to be used on, you know, very sensitive military installations and things, not for you and me in our house. And they're not going to take down the grid, the broader grid. They're meant for, you know, destroying command and control kind of information. So they may be very effective weapons, and I do believe they exist, but I don't think it's something you and I probably need.
Okay. Okay. Also, a great movie, I think it's called Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 12. They make this thing and put it in the back of a van.
I remember.
And he turns because he's afraid of it.
Yeah.
And he takes care of the – I mean, he knocks out power in Las Vegas because they're at the right spot.
Yeah.
Can that happen on a micro level?
Yeah, I watched it. They certainly could have a big pulse like that where they could generate a large pulse. Whether or not you could take down a city like that, I kind of doubt it. You probably would need to be aerial above it where you could do a line of sight down on it. Because, you know, again, the idea is to couple as much energy into as many different conductors as you can, right? So that you could overload everything. if you're local on the ground in one area and you fire something, you're only going to really affect that area heavily. So I kind of think it was probably not accurate in that way, but it was certainly interesting to see. I remember it very well. Yeah.
I love that. It was like, dude, that's an EMP, but okay.
Yeah.
So next question, will aluminum foil wrapped around the head prevent mind reading?
You have to try that out. I don't know.
And about plans. Oh, so one of the big reasons if our grid goes down is because a lot of the transformers, we don't have backups.
Right, right. Yeah, that's the big concern. One of the big concerns is that we have these huge transformers. And I know people are thinking of transformers like they're out on their utility pole, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about transformers that are the size of buildings, right? Mm-hmm. And the transformers are not made in the United States, my understanding. They're made overseas, and they have very few spares if they were damaged. And so you imagine if you damage, you know, 100 of them in the United States and you only have 6 spares, you're going to be in trouble, right? Because you don't have anybody to replace them. And so what I have read is that it could be anywhere from 3 months to a year to have replacement transformers made and shipped in. I don't know if that's accurate. I'm not close enough to that industry to know. But even if you were kind and you said the 3 months number is right instead of the year, 3 months of a major portion of the grid being down is a world in which we have not lived before. It would right. would be pretty serious. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be. Absolutely. Let's see if I got how effective are DIY cages? I think you covered that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. So you're on your Disaster Prepper. Is that correct?
The YouTube channel Disaster Prepper. Yep.
You sit in this chamber that they lock you in.
Yeah.
And you show people exactly how to make Faraday cage. Mm-hmm. And you show, I mean, and it's some great videos. As a matter of fact, I can see a Faraday cage out of a trash can I have that's galvanized. I have mm-hmm. the aluminum tape, mm-hmm. you know, to help go around and seal the lid and everything. Yeah. And but a lot of that's on your YouTube channel. Also, you talked about the blanket, and you said it was very expensive, like to cover mm-hmm. your car, yep. your electronic bike, maybe even a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm. Or a generator. People use it for generators as well.
Does it have to go underneath the generator?
No, it doesn't. If the generator's sitting on concrete or earth, you can drape the cloth over and lay it on the concrete or the earth. It ends up the earth is actually a reasonable conductor because it's so big and so spread out, you can end up. So the bottom of your cage, if you want to think about it as a cage, it's not exactly a cage, but if you want to think about it that way, is essentially the earth. And what you're doing is laying a protective barrier over it. Remember that the energy is primarily coming from above anyway, right? So you're trying to put a barrier between, as the energy is going to get, there's two things that happen when energy, when a high frequency wave hits a conductive barrier. Part of it gets absorbed by it and part of it gets reflected by it. And okay. you would like both of those things to happen. And then some amount of energy is going to come through the other side. And this allows you to reduce the energy that comes through the other side.
So you said that it's an expensive blanket.
It is.
What size is it first? Like a 10 by 10?
Oh, it can be any size you want. People have made them as large as 40 feet by 25 feet.
Okay.
So that's the biggest I've done. And that was for a big supersized SUV that they wanted to have covered. The cloth comes in a 5 foot wide roll. All right. And 200 feet long, potentially, and 5 foot wide. So if you need something that's 5 foot by 5 foot, it's pretty easy to do. You just pull off 5 feet of it, cut it, and you got a 5 foot by 5 foot. The problem is if you need something that's 10 foot by 10 foot, now you got to pull off 2 10-foot sections and sew them together to get a 10 foot by 10 foot cloth, and that takes some effort and some expense and stuff. And so it's $20 a linear foot for that cloth. So you get a 5 foot wide,
okay. 1 foot,
you know, every foot you pull out of the roll was $20. So a 5 foot by 5 foot would cost you $100, right? And that maybe isn't so much if that's enough for you. Now maybe to cover up a little Honda generator or something, maybe pretty reasonable. But when you're covering up your SUV, you know, it becomes pretty expensive. It might cost a couple $1,000s by the time you get a cover that's that big that can go over it. So it's expensive.
It would look really weird, too, to cover your entire house with that.
Yeah, it would look really weird to cover your house, yeah.
I guess it could be done. So what we're going to do now, because everyone's having any questions that we haven't asked, here's what I want you to do in the comment box there, in the chat box. Put like four or five question marks. I'll give you an example like that, and then type your question.
I like Emily's comment. Holy crap, that's expensive. She is right.
So do your question like that. We'll see. We'll see the question marks and we'll see your. Now, if it's already been asked, don't ask again. I mean, but if you got any questions of that. And so let's talk about some of the other things that you do have, because everything you have in your store literally has to do with EMP, except your books. But a lot of it has to do with EMP. So what other devices, things do you have in your store?
I only have, if you counted all the products, there might be 15 products. It's not, I'm not running a big store. I've got those custom ferrites, which I mentioned to people. They're usually bought in threes or fours, depending on how your house is wired. I've got those survivor symbol cards, which aren't EMP related. I just think they're really cool. I brought one of these anti-tracking pouches. These are phone pouches that I had custom made, and I tested them. And the whole purpose of those are, you know, with the pandemic, people are worried about the government tracking their cell phones, rightly so, frankly. And they want a way of being able to kind of get off of that being tracked, traced kind of thing. Those pouches will do that. Any phone that is out there, that if you put it in it and close it up, the phone company won't know where you're at anymore, which is kind of neat. And then, of course, EMP bags. I sell a bunch of different sizes EMP bags. The conductive cloth, we talked about that for generators and things like that. What else is there? There's some gaskets that go around for like makeshift Faraday cages as well. And that's primarily stuff that in the books, like you said, I always sell my books on my website too.
So some guy named Engineer 775, Scott Hunt, and he says, hello.
Scott Hunt. Hello, Scott.
Yeah. You know, Scott.
Yeah.
He's in the house now. So, let's see, here's another question. Let's see here. I think I'm missing questions here. That was my example. Talk about your fiction books, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. My fiction books are called The Survivalist. It's a 12 book series. I gave you a little spiel on it earlier. It follows right after a pandemic. It's a big gun book. If you like guns and shooting and some martial arts, things that I was interested in are all kind of mixed in there. I have a number of survival tips that are told within the story. They're never like, it's never a teaching book, but it's always got interesting sort of things they figure out. The two main characters, like I said, are very different. And one of them is a hardened ex-con that escapes from prison. And another one is this U.S. Marshal who's his son. And it sort of worked with the government that reestablishes itself and some of the adventures that they have as they go around. It has a little supernatural element to it. I have people getting mutated by the virus that occurs and stuff. So it's a good fun. I'd love to see it made into a movie one day just so I could watch it. I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Sweet. Question here. How about metal garages?
Yeah, metal garages. A lot of people have asked about that. You do get some shielding. I think it would be very similar to like the shipping container type things. The doors, obviously, and any windows and things like that would compromise it from being too good, but you would have some shielding. My guess is probably around 20 dB, which is similar to what a shipping container would provide.
Okay. How about what's the opinion of the difference kind of between a EMP and a CME?
Yeah, distinctly different. And it is important that people understand the difference in those. One is that a CME, a coronal mass ejection, is from the sun, basically a big plasma that comes and washes over the earth, and it perturbates our geomagnetic field, right? And that causes some currents to flow on long conductors, things like our power grid, buried conductors, things like that. And it absolutely will cause damage to the grid. We've seen it cause damage to the grid before. So, and it will occur. We, in our lifetimes, yours and mine, for us, we will have a big coronal mass ejection hit the earth and cause some kind of disturbance. Whether it'll destroy the grid, I don't know, but it will occur. And people often point to the Carrington event as what, you know, could happen. And we certainly could have something like that. The big difference between a CME and an EMP is a CME is basically like the E3 of an EMP. It's only low frequency. So you don't need a Faraday cage. Your car is going to be just fine. None of that's going to be affected by this solar emission. What will happen is the grid could get destroyed and all of the ramifications that causes could happen. So you still need preparations. You still need to be able to feed yourself and have fresh water and all those other things. But it's not so much the Faraday cage kind of things because those are way too small devices to be affected by a solar event.
How long would water and sewer work? I guess a city, the pumps.
Yeah, as soon as their backup systems failed, I mean, they're going to have some backup systems that might survive. But if they lose grid power, they're not going to be on for too long, a couple of days maybe.
So I read an article. Just tell me if I'm wrong here. 60%, I think that Scott Hunt and I were talking about, it's like 60% of all power in the United States is to start motors.
I don't know if that's true or not. So I don't know. I can't comment on that.
We said it, so it's true.
Okay, sounds good.
How about, I had a friend the other day ask me, how about an underground bunker?
Yeah, I have looked at underground bunkers. I had the good fortune of someone hiring me to go out and measure underground bunkers at how well they shielded against an EMP. And we looked at a number of them. And the short answer is the bunkers, if they're not compromised, do a great job. Because you're under the earth by maybe 20 feet or something, right? But what happens is many of the old bunkers that people have out there, they have compromised them by installing things like power coming down through, you know, conduits and telephone wires and other things that breach down into their underground bunker. And what we found was that, well, almost all of them provided modest protection. You'd be surprised. You're like way down in this bunker and you get a cell phone call and you're like, how's this possible? And the reason is because of the penetrations that people have brought into that bunker. If you took all those penetrations out and sealed up the holes, you'd have fantastic protection. But that, unfortunately, they get compromised pretty easily.
So I think you've covered this. A true Faraday cage only protects against radiation with wavelengths longer than the smallest hole.
Yeah. So, yeah, the idea is that you want the holes in your Faraday cage to be smaller than the wavelength so that nothing can get through. The wave can't get through it. And the number that you, if you look at and you run the tables, it's about a millimeter. If the hole is smaller than a millimeter or smaller, you get very good protection from an EMP.
Okay.
So people ask about like window screening and things like that. Very small. If you can get a millimeter sized hole, it does a great job. But I will say this. I know this from measurement. Like I said, I have taken a galvanized garbage can. It's a fun experiment. And you measure the shielding and then you take a drill bit, maybe like an eighth inch drill bit. And you go and you start drilling holes in the side of the Faraday cage. It's a very slow compromise. The signal levels will start to deteriorate. The shielding will, but it's very slow. And that's because the maximum dimension across the hole is pretty small and most of the area is still metal, right? And so you don't compromise it that much with small holes. But if you take a big knife and you carve a little slot in the side of the can, the whole thing goes to nothing. You have almost no shielding. Wow. So it's a fun experiment.
I've seen some videos on YouTube. It was years ago where they actually took hardware cloth, like, you know, with quarter inch holes, you know, the quarter inch like you would use for bottom of a rabbit cage.
Yep.
And build a cage. Does that really work where you can actually see the devices in there and it's still
excellent? Not so great is the short answer. I did a video specific. I had heard so many times, oh, my chicken wire Faraday cage is just as good as the aluminum foil. So there's a video on my channel, Disaster Prepper on YouTube, that they can go see aluminum foil versus chicken wire. And the difference is significant. The chicken wire gives you about 10 dB of shielding, which is something, but the holes are so many and they're so large that you just don't get that great of shielding.
One guy wants to buy all your books. Can you give him a single bundle price? I'll let you email.
Go to the website. There's a bundle on disasterprepare.com. There's a 12 book bundle.
Oh yeah. Sweet. See,
yeah.
You ask and you shall receive. Another question about metal roofs. Let's see here. Thoughts about using window screens to wrap around. That's kind of the same as chicken wire. Yeah. But
It's smaller. It's smaller holes, so it does a little better. We built one. I don't know. We tested chicken wire. I mean, window screen a while back. It's just hard to work with. You know, it pokes you and it doesn't fold right. It's difficult to build a good cage out of that. If you're good with it and you can build a frame system and wrap it up really tight, it probably would do okay. It just, when we worked with it, we got frustrated with it. It wasn't my favorite stuff to work with.
Batteries. Batteries laying around, like alkaline batteries, rechargeable batteries, they should be good, right?
Yeah, they're fine. They won't be damaged.
Okay. Someone asked a combination of a CME and an EMP. I'm not sure
Wow.
That would be some great timing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, boy, that would be something. We just gave whoever that was, Brandon just told our enemies, whoever they are out there, exactly how to destroy the United States.
Yeah.
As soon as the next big CME hits the earth, detonate that baby overhead and we're done. Yeah. We're all done.
Okay, here's another one. Will antenna lightning surge protectors protect a ham radio?
I doubt it.
Okay.
Because the antenna on the ham radio is still going to bring in the lightning protectors I've seen are meant for the power. And it is helpful to have surge protectors that protect your power lines. The problem with all radios is they've got the antenna system. And unless, you know, some people do disconnect the antennas when they're not using the radio system. That's a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But if you leave it connected, you know, you've got this great antenna out there and you're going to bring in tons of energy into the system. So I don't think that would be that great.
How do you protect a fifth wheel trailer with solar?
Yeah, people have asked me about that over the years, various RVs and things like that. And it's sort of like a house. You're going to have to treat it similarly. You know, you can put surge protectors and ferrites on it. And each case is a little bit different. I've helped a number of people look at their RVs and these trailers to put the places, you know, put the protective devices on. And that's the way you have to do it.
A 55-barrel steel drum.
Yeah, I haven't tested that one. I've been asked it a few times. You know, the metal is plenty thick enough. I'm not worried about the seam. They're usually, you know, folded over and all of that. It would be the lid and whether you could get that lid properly sealed where you didn't have any kind of a gap or seam. And, I, you know, it can be very, very small gap and still let the energy in. So you'd have to really make sure you had a good seam. It may do fantastic. I just haven't tested it.
Okay. So, and then we have another car one, but we've already went through that. They can, so what questions are we not asking? That's the important question. What, I mean, cause you know, we're just preppers or people trying to maybe prepare for EMP. What's some advice that we might not would read or think about that, would be important? You know, what do we not know to even ask?
I mean, I think in terms of an EMP, there's a few things that people get confused that are really important. We've gone over them tonight. The difference between an EMP and a CME, for example, the sun's threat versus an EMP. Understanding what the difference is on the overlap of those, that's real important. And probably the most important thing of all is understanding that these are events that are going to affect you in many ways, right? Not just your electronics being damaged, right? But they're going to affect your ability to get food. They're going to affect your ability to get water. They're going to affect your ability to heat your house. There's going to be lots and lots of impacts. Get information and so forth. Get to your money. And you need to put in place a really solid preparedness plan that addresses all those different impacts. Because having a functioning radio and, you know, a functioning laptop or whatever it is you might be find useful isn't going to be something you can eat. And so you're going to need to think through all those preparations. And so I always really encourage people to really sit down and put together a good solid plan like that. And if you do that, whether it's an EMP or a pandemic or whatever the threat may be, you're kind of ready for those impacts when they come, right? I mean, I just want people to think about that instead of just solely on the specifics of just what the EMP threat is.
Doesn't a large generator come with amp proof since it has a case around it? And I think your answer to that is no.
Yeah, so a lot of people... they have these, there's two kinds of generators, right? There's this portable generators that you roll out when you need them, they're in your garage. And then there's the standby generators that sit outside the home. They're typically plumbed with propane and things. And the short answer is neither of them are guaranteed to survive an EMP. They're both pretty rugged. They're both pretty robust. The more sophisticated your generator, the more likely it is to be damaged. So if it has little fancy displays and all these various things, it's more likely to be damaged than if it's, you know, an old hand crank Briggs and Stratton kind of thing, right? Big coils of wire, like in motors and things, are not likely to get damaged. Yes, they'll couple energy in them, but it's brief energy. It's a very small amount of time, and they can take a lot of heating before they're going to be melting coils and things. And the generators in overall are pretty robust, but they're also really, really important, right? Because if we lose our power, people always ask, well, what do I need a generator for? That's a great question. What do I need a generator for? Why do I need solar power? If the grid goes down, everything's going to be, the whole world's going to collapse anyway. What does it matter? And the short answer is that nobody knows the grid's going to go down forever. The grid might go down and come back up an hour every day. There may be a way they figure out how to bring limited power to people. Having a functioning house of electronics would make your life a lot better, right? than if you're sitting there and you have no way of washing clothes or cooking food or other things like that. So having a functional home of electronics is very important. Having a backup power source like a generator is even better, because now, yes, maybe the grid does stay down for 2 weeks. If you, as long as you're prepared, you can roll out and provide some limited power to your home. And living with 1 hour of electricity per day is immensely better than living with no electricity a day, right? So I always tell people those are real important.
I'm going to answer the next two questions, but just because I think it's better for me to answer them. From Solark, I'm going to give it a possibly pretty good. Okay. You don't have to respond at all.
No, I think I didn't know you wanted me to. I think they make a good product. I have no objection to them at all. Yeah. And I don't think they wanted me advertising without knowing the intricacies of their product, which is fine. My understanding is they're the only EMP tested inverting, solar power generator system out there. And I know a number of customers who use them. So I have no reservations about it.
And then I'm going to answer this next one, because I have this product on my car and I'm going to give it an EMP shield. I have it on my car. They sent me one. But let me just tell you, I asked them suckers 3 times and had them scheduled to come on this to get questions just like this. And all 3 times they canceled. And so I'm not a fan of theirs. And can I get sued for that?
Don't know.
I don't know either. But I'm not. I told them I wanted them to come on. We had them scheduled for 3 times. And they all 3 times they canceled. So I don't know if it works. I think we kind of went through that earlier if you go back and listen. But I'm going to give them a thumbs down just because they're disrespectful to our show. Someone asked, no, his book series is based on, a lot of latecomers here, is based on a pandemic. Let's see here. First 20 minutes briefly. Old cars. Can you make a blanket statement that of all cars, 60% of them will probably work after EMP? Is that a good?
I don't think you can safely say a number.
Okay.
My guess is the majority of vehicles will survive an EMP, but most will experience some kind of anomalies that can be reset and cleared out.
Okay. Several minutes long. Oh, an EMP, is it sudden or does it take several minutes to go? And the further away you're from an EMP, does it protect you or does it just travel?
Yeah, it's not exactly distance. It has a strange pattern to it, kind of a horseshoe pattern if it's in the atmosphere like that. So it's not solely based on different distance where your field levels are. But being further away is a good thing, and having Earth between you and the sky where it detonates is a good thing. But the field levels are a little more complicated than that. And in terms of its timing, the EMP will, the E1 and the E2 will be over before you ever knew it occurred. You will never even know it occurred. The E3 could last for longer. It could last for seconds or minutes. So you could potentially know that something's going on. And if you knew an EMP had occurred, the first thing you'd want to do is run outside and throw the breaker on your house so that you could disconnect from any surge that might still be coming in on the power line.
Okay. So let's just go to the next one here. In the atmosphere, will the atmosphere be charged or is it immediately dissipated because of Earth and it grounds it?
Yeah, I don't believe it remains charged. I'm not a physicist. It does affect, though, but I'm not saying that for sure. I don't know that for sure. I do know it would affect communications for a period of time. Certainly could damage satellites and things like that. But I don't know that the atmosphere itself remains charged. I don't know that it's even really relevant if, we're not going to be 100 miles in the atmosphere. Nobody flies at that altitude or anything like that.
So if I owned a couple nuclear weapons and I wanted to shoot them over North America, I would send one up and let it explode and wait like 48 hours and send another one up.
Yeah, lots of people have suggested that. The reason I don't think that likely is it's difficult to deploy a nuclear weapon. You got to have a high altitude ballistic missile. You got to have the element of surprise. I'm pretty sure you could get one of those things off maybe over the United States one time and catch us with our pants down. I don't know that you can do it 2 days later and catch us again. I might be wrong, you know, but I hope I'm not.
Good, because that's what one of the fears of all preppers, that they get all their stuff out now and it's working. And
the next day,
And the next day, boom, boom. Yeah.
More than likely, it would be a different kind of attack. That's what I think.
Right, yeah, okay. So, but yeah, I've heard that so many times. People go, I would wait months before I get my stuff out, and the likelihood is just astronomical.
Well, and the return on your attack gets smaller, right? If you cause most of the damage with your first attack, you're not really worried about you're my cell phone or you're my computers. You're worried about government infrastructure, and most of that's going to be hit with the first one and affected anyway. So I'm not sure the enemy would see that much value in trying to deploy, you know, do the same attack again.
Let's make it clear. I don't own any nuclear.
Yeah. Okay. We heard you, Forrest. We heard you.
And I don't have any ballistic missiles anywhere in my arsenal that I know of. So let's just make that clear. So a lot of people rely, and if you get sick of questions, let us know. A lot of people rely on GPS, mm-hmm. and we know you said earlier that some of them probably could survive an EMP attack. Mm-hmm. And for a GPS, you need what, at least two or three signals to work?
Yeah. There's a constellation above you at any time that uses a number of them.
Do they
rotate? Go ahead.
Our GPS systems are stationary above us and rotate with the Earth, correct?
I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not, because I think they come over the horizon. I didn't know that they were geosynchronous, if that's the case. It's not an area that I've looked into that much.
Okay.
I can't intelligently say.
You're a NASA scientist. You're supposed to know where every bolt in the atmosphere is.
Yeah. You'd be surprised how little I know about stuff related to space.
Okay. Okay. So we don't know that. Okay.
I didn't know that.
Okay. Again, back to anything that, let me make sure I answered all the questions that were, anything we don't know again that, so building a Faraday cage, I mean, plain and simple, that's the answer to a lot of this, but you have to be, you've got a great video. It's a great video. And they lock you in this dungeon and you go step by step and you talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that will take care of all your laptops, all your electronics. So the idea, guys, if you're a prepper, have extra radios, have an extra laptop, have extra things and put in there and just seal it. Mm-hmm. And use what you have. I have a phone right here. Just use it, but maybe have a backup or something in there. And that's how we, on our retreat, we have Android phones because we can totally put what we want on an Android phone. And they're all in a Faraday cage. We have our Wi-Fi system, all that stuff. So we're going to have like a local Wi-Fi system. It's all protected. And if it's protected properly, like you do in your video, garbage can with the seal around it. Now, what's this, your seal that you have? Is it a tape or is it just, how is it different? And
yeah. So when we first did that, probably one of my early videos, we used, you know, like aluminum duct tape to tape up the outside of the can. Mm-hmm. It works fine. That's great. The only thing is if you work with it much, you know, it'll cut your hands up, taking it on and off. We have blood everywhere working with that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just a pain to get in and out of. Right. And so.
And you can't peel it off too. It's hard to peel off.
It is. Yeah. Cause it's very sticky. And just in case people are wondering, there's expensive tape, this expensive copper tape, and then there's cheap aluminum duct tape from Lowe's. The aluminum duct tape just does as good as the copper tape. So just save your money and buy the cheap tape. But what we found was it was easier. I bought a whole bunch of conductive gaskets, which are these little spongy metal covered, you know, foam, and they with a sticker on the back. And you can stick those inside the lid of the can. I have a picture on my website of how that's done. And then the can just go on and go off, and it seals up. Essentially, that little metal gets compressed as it seals, and it creates a really nice tight seal around the can, the lid of the can. And so it's just much easier to use than the tape. I don't know that it works any better, but it just is easier to use.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Let me look through the sheet. So people went on Facebook today and were asking questions, and I put them on a sheet here. I think I want to get back to
Let me answer this one for us, because this one's one I've heard a lot. I see Wake Up in the post something about the inside of your can. Okay. I always get asked, when I built mine in my demonstrator, I don't put anything inside the can, like cardboard, to line it. And so many times people have asked, well, should I line the can with something like cardboard? And the short answer is, sure, you can line the can with something non-conductive, and that's probably a good idea even. If everything you're putting in there already has a plastic housing around it, there's no exposed metal, there's no real need to line the can, right? Because nothing's going to short out anywhere. But if you're putting things in there with antennas or power cords or things that might touch the inside of the can, then yes, it's a good idea to line the inside of the can.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to get back. I was going to ask. So let's say 5 years ago, your likelihood of an EMP possibly happening from a 0 to 100 5 years ago.
Percentage?
Yeah.
Well, again, these are high impact, low frequency. I think the chance of an EMP happening in a given year, 5 years ago, I would have given less than 1%.
And today?
And today I would give it something greater than that, but certainly not greater than 10%.
Okay.
I think the odds are still unlikely that it would occur, because it's a big thing, right? Anyone initiates that attack on any country, it's going to be a big thing. But we do have emboldened enemies out there right now, unlike what we had years before, and I could see it happening. I don't think it's impossible.
So we had the Carrington effect back in
1859.
Mm-hmm. And supposedly every 100 years, mm-hmm. A solar flare or a CME, mm-hmm. it's supposed to be the cycle that we get another big one.
Right. Statistically, it's about every 100 years or so. And obviously, we're well past due.
Way overdue. And so you made a statement earlier that you think in our lifetime that we're going to have a significant CME come our way.
I do. I think so. We've gotten missed by a couple just in the last 10 years that were enormous, right? They just happened to go the wrong direction and the Earth didn't get hit. But sometimes you're in their path of it and you end up getting hit. And the question will be, you know, we can see CMEs coming, right? They don't travel at the speed of light, unlike a solar flare. But solar flares aren't what's going to take out the grid. It's going to be a big CME that takes out the grid. And we can see them coming. The question will be, will we have enough forethought to try and shut down the grid or go into some protective mode? And would it even matter if we do? There's an argument whether it would make any difference or not. And I don't know the answer to that. My guess is we wouldn't. We would probably think, oh, we've withstood others. It'll probably be fine. And that might be, you know, to our detriment. But yeah, I think it's likely in our lifetimes, you know, that we will see some kind of a large CME affect the Earth.
Wow. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, that's something to prepare for then, for mm-hmm. sure.
Yes.
So I think we might, what do we not know? Please educate us.
Well, one thing I know, I had an interesting discussion with some NASA engineers about CMEs. This might be of interest to your audience. And the question was, well, we can see the CME coming and we know it's big, right? We've got a bunch of satellites watching the sun all the time. And since we know it, can't we just predict what it's going to do to the Earth and know if it's going to affect us or not? And the interesting thing was, they said that you wouldn't know, it would almost be a minute by minute thing as it enveloped the Earth and perturbated the Earth's magnetic fields. You would not really know its effect until it was happening. You'd have very little actual, like, I know for sure this is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And even though you knew it was a big one, you wouldn't exactly know its effects. It was very hard to predict. It was just too complex, is my understanding.
Do you know Jeff, is it Yago?
I know that name.
He wrote a book on EMP and did some testing and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, he was at PrepperCan. I met him just a few, he's got a book on it that I have. But I haven't read it yet.
But I know I've heard his name.
Okay. Implants harmful during an EMP, you know,
implant, like ear implants.
Cochlear, yeah.
I don't know. I haven't looked at that. I don't know how susceptible those are. I had a chance, like I said, to look at pacemakers, but I haven't had a chance to look at other advice like that.
Okay, I got another question. I mean, you know everything about NASA and all top secret things. How about the little planet that NASA's blocking that we can't see?
Yeah, Planet X or whatever it is.
Planet X, you know. Yeah. Please tell us about that. Yeah. I don't know enough about it, but my friend Kyle is the biggest conspiracy theory. He thinks ants are little robots spying from the government.
Yeah. Well, I will say, you know, I'm not speaking on behalf of NASA, so just to be clear, but my thought of it is this. Now, I'm a little bit of a conspiracy guy, too, because crazy things that you think, no, that never happened. You find out 30 years later that was going on. They were dropping mosquitoes out the back of those airplanes infected or something, right? So anything's possible. But the problem with things in space is that NASA doesn't own, you know, the looking glass into space. Everyone, including amateur people all over the world, see space. And they're usually the ones that find things because there's so many people looking, right? And so if there's something out there like a hidden planet or something like that, there would be so many people that had evidence of it. I think it'd be impossible to keep hidden.
Yeah. Right? Oh, it's Planet X. Someone put X.
Planet X. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Nibiru. Yeah. That's right. I heard that too.
Yeah. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy, but you're a conspiracy theorist. That's kind of interesting.
Well, a little bit. I don't rule things out off the top. I mean, because some crazy things that you think would never have happened, human experiments and things that you think that would never happen, but we have done it, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't rule them out entirely. I'm like, well, I'll listen.
See, that's what Kyle's my co-host on the podcast. And he says every conspiracy theory has some truth to it. And he wants me to he wants me to believe that. I'm not sure I can. So, you know, here's a question that's already been asked, I think, but could you give your opinion? And we're going to wrap this up right after this. You know, guys driving to work and all of a sudden EMP happens.
Yeah.
I think from what you're saying, let me tell you if I'm wrong, your car may stop. You turn it off. You pull the key out, put it back in and crank it. A good majority of them cars will work, but the interstate will probably be blocked from the cars that can't work.
Mm-hmm. And accidents.
And you said you just have to shoot them to get them out of the way. Oh, wait, you didn't say that. No.
Yeah. It would be unfortunate, I think, to be out in a heavily trafficked area if an EMP went off, because you think about if a majority of cars experience some kind of anomaly, what's going to happen? You know, people are going to be crashing into each other like crazy, right? There will be jams everywhere. And emergency services won't be able to respond. So these traffic jams are going to remain for a long time, right? And figuring out how do I get from here back to my loved ones and get us to safety would be a real challenge. There's a story for you right there. And I think there's been a number of those written, but
yeah,
I think that could be really challenging.
Okay. Two most important questions. Is Roswell real?
Yeah, absolutely. It is.
Okay. I'm convinced. And did we really go to the moon?
Yeah, I think that one's an absolutely too. So,
okay. And you've met the aliens, so you know there's things like aliens.
I wish I had that insight that that I knew about that. I believe we went to the moon. I know there's a lot of, we have lots of pictures of people on the moon and of vehicles on the moon. We can see parts of the moon we've been to from the Earth. So it's not like, you know. That's a little hard to argue.
You know, I didn't know the Earth was flat until just recently.
Yeah. Oh, get my kids involved in that discussion. That is interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, I mean, you've answered every question known to man here.
Let's take one more for us.
Okay.
I see it, and I remember it's one that people ask a lot. Truth Seeker said something about airplanes.
Yeah.
Common question we get, if you don't mind, take 1 minute. So the short answer is, and if anybody's ever been in an airplane hit by lightning, I happened to be in one about a year or two ago where lightning hit right down the center body and cracked right through the main part of the cabin we were sitting in. Very, very frightening. But you know what? Plane kept on flying. Pilot got on, had a little chuckle, said, "Hey, I just got hit by lightning." And we could smell a little something burning in the air. I mean, it was frightening, but the airplane kept flying. And airplanes are extremely redundant. They have quad redundancy systems, typically meaning four strings of everything. So yes, you could, an EMP could absolutely cause problems on an airplane, but they're so redundant. I do not think airplanes would in large numbers fall out of the sky. I think most of them would survive just fine. Now, how well the ground would be able to handle them, bring them in, it would be chaotic, but they would all have to land immediately in the, anywhere in that area. But yeah, I think that most all of them would survive.
Gotcha. It would take hours to literally empty the sky of planes.
I'm sure. Yeah.
So, well, I think that's enough. Now I hear about your website. Your website is disaster prepper, preparer.com, correct?
Yes, disasterprepare.com. Mm-hmm.
And so you got your products on there. You got your you called them ferrites. Mm-hmm. Don't confuse them with ferrets. You don't be buying ferrets and putting them around your cables. They'll eat your cables probably. You can buy the blanket. You have the blanket. People can order it to size, I guess, if they want to cover a motorcycle or electronic bike or something, or electric bike.
Yeah.
And you have your book series, and you even have it as a bundle. Mm-hmm. So, just tell us different ways that we can. And you, I also want to tell people that he is. I mean, if you're going to hire a consultant for your bug out retreat about, you know, protecting your stuff, you are for hire. I mean, you do consulting all the time for people with bug out retreats and corporations.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So tell everyone how they can get up with Dr. Arthur Bradley and buy your books and support you in what you're doing, even though you work at NASA, because everyone that works at NASA, I think, makes about $4 million a year in salary.
Right. Yeah, without the perks. Right. Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Okay. this is what you love and you're passionate about is not only helping people with the questions about EMPs and CMEs, but also preparedness and mm-hmm. making sure that people are prepared. And right. So tell us how you can help people and how people can get up with you.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, you know, my journey started, I have a family, and when the 9/11 attacks occurred, it really got me thinking about being better prepared, like a lot of people, right? It was a real wake-up call, and my first love, really, in terms of preparedness, is helping families get better prepared, just in general, that they can weather dangerous events. And that's why I wrote my handbook to practical disaster preparedness, and if you're only going to buy one book, I think that's a book that's worth buying. It has a lot of useful information about just creating a really effective preparedness plan. And then my interests, you know, my technical interests are electronics. And so I ended up in this world of EMP and I had a lot of questions that I had to answer. And I was fortunate to have the ability to do experiments and things that I think a lot of people couldn't do. So I was able to get real world data for things. And I've tried to share that on YouTube. You don't have to pay anything. You just go and watch them, see what you can learn. And I try and answer questions as often as I can because there's a lot of misinformation about any topic, but EMP in particular. People think they know things because they've heard it, but they don't really necessarily know the truth. So I'm always happy to answer emails. People can reach, there's a contact me button on the website. They can go there and they can send me messages if they got questions.
There's his website. It's on there. I know several people have asked. And you got a great YouTube channel as well. Mm-hmm. It goes through how to make a Faraday cage. You actually walk people through it. If you guys watch that and it's educational, and you learn something, you do it, send me $10. I am just totally kidding. So, but that, hey, thank you so much for coming on. Again, I don't know if I even said this, but you were on my podcast a couple years ago, and it is my most listened to podcast by like a factor of three. I told you that earlier. People want to know about this because, from someone that knows.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me to come on.
And if you don't know about it, you at least do a good job pretending.
That's right. I'm trying.
So, hey, thank you for coming on. Hey, everyone, don't forget next week, we actually have Survival 401k. If you remember that, I'm just going to tell you how to take your retirement money right there next weekend. Ross from Survival 401k. So be here next same time, 8 o'clock Eastern time next Thursday. And Dr. Bradley, again, you're the bomb. I mean, great. I mean, great guest. Unbelievable.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for all that you're doing for our little community as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, everyone, we're going to say goodnight. This will be in a podcast tomorrow as well. And this will be up on YouTube. You can share it with your friends and watch it at a later time as well. So good night, everyone. We'll talk to you later. Peace out.
Thanks for listening to the Prepping Academy podcast. Preppers unite at www.preppingacademy.com.
Are you a prepper or homesteader looking to connect with like-minded people in your area? Looking to start your own preparedness group? Already have a group? Well, look no further than PrepperNet. PrepperNet is dedicated to personal responsibility, individual freedoms, and being self-reliant. PrepperNet has monthly meetings in over 100 cities where you can meet and learn with like-minded people in your area. PrepperNet, where preppers unite. Find us online at PrepperNet.com.